Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to Indie Streak. My name is Rachel Galvin, and as you know, I interview film industry professionals on this show. If you've missed any of my shows, you can go back and listen to the archives. I have a show I did recently where we talked about Jews in the different types of military battles, which was perfect for yesterday, which was Armed Forces Day. So if you haven't had a chance to go back and listen to that one, I would give that a listen. It's called A Call to Serve, Florida Jews in the U.S. Military, and it's actually going to be playing tonight on WLRN at 9 p.m., so give that a listen. But today I'm interviewing Scott Shermer, director of Sound, and I do believe I have Scott on the line. Scott, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Thanks for coming on the show today. We're going to dive right in, and why don't you tell people a little bit about the movie for those that haven't seen it yet?
Okay, Sound is about a fifth-grade boy who discovers a severed human head in his older brother's closet at the very beginning of the movie, and that's when he realizes his older brother's a serial killer. He kind of keeps going back in the room and finding different heads every so often, and he was very worried about whether or not to keep a secret that his brother is doing this from his parents, and at the same time, he's also dealing with bullies at school, and his brother actually is a nice guy to him sometimes, so he starts taking his brother's advice on how to treat these bullies. So it's really kind of a love story between two brothers, even though one of them's a psycho killer.
Yeah, it's really an interesting dynamic, and the majority of the film, you don't see the gore. It's all kind of in your head, except for one portion where you have that movie within a movie. Was that something that was within the original book, or was that developed for the movie?
Yes, it's really pretty faithful to the book, and we like the way that worked out. You really get to know Marty. You get inside his skin. Marty's the main character, the fifth-grade boy, and we kind of liked keeping the horror at bay for a little while, just so that the movie could kind of get under your skin in other ways before all that visceral stuff started happening.
I think what makes it so effective is that the characters, really, you get to know them because you do develop a relationship with the characters through the movie. How did you work with your actors to kind of bring across that naturalness, that natural quality with them and the relationship between the characters?
Well, I'm glad that you thought they were natural.
I did, absolutely.
Awesome. We don't have a lot of resources here in Indiana when it comes to acting. We are very lucky to be next to Indiana University. So for the older brother, that boded well. But for the little kid, for the fifth grade character, the star of the movie, we just lucked out finding Gavin Brown. And I've worked with kids before on some other movies, and I guess I've worked with some that have had quite a bit of theatrical training, and they worked out all pretty well. But Gavin had no experience whatsoever.
Wow.
And I have had good luck with some kids that have had no experience, because if you have none, they're kind of a blank slate, and you don't have to unteach them anything, because a lot of kids who do have any experience, it's probably musical theater or children's theater, where they're told to, like, keep their eyes really wide and project their voices and over-exaggerate everything, or they've done commercials. So
right.
Gavin didn't have any of that. He was very naturalistic, and it's really just a matter of keeping him engaged and interested and making it seem not very much like acting. So I don't know.
Was it difficult
somehow it worked
to direct children? Besides Gavin, was the other children in the scene, was it difficult to direct them?
I wouldn't say that any one child is difficult. Having a bunch of children together is difficult, because especially if they're boys, and especially if it's a scene in a public bathroom, because then potty humor comes out. It's hard to keep more than one boy focused. So whenever we had two boys or more, it was a bit of a challenge. But all of the kids individually were really good actors, actually, by themselves.
Was the scene in the bathroom difficult because of the sound in there with all the tile? Was that hard?
Oh, yeah.
Did you get a lot of bouncing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty awful.
The sound in the movie is one of my biggest. It's better than it has any right to be, but it's one of those things that we definitely want to get better at with each new production that we do. And that's just a matter of microphones and dubbing. And we actually planned to do a lot of dialogue replacement after we had the first edit of the movie together. But we knew from the get-go that we were racing puberty. And Gavin, at that time, had such a nice, vulnerable quality to his voice when we shot. And we got the narration recorded just in the nick of time. Thank God. Because when we brought him in for looping, the vulnerable quality was all gone. He sounded way too grown up, way too mature, and there was nothing he could do that was going to change that. So we did not end up looping any of his lines.
Wow. Okay. So you did a lot of ADR overall? A lot of looping?
You know, honestly, not too much. We did a little with the parents, I think, and maybe just a teeny bit with Steve, the older brother. But really, I would say 97% of it is what we recorded on the day.
Now, where did you find Ethan that played Steve?
Ethan was in a theatrical production of My Fair Lady here in Bloomington, Indiana, and Arthur Culliver was doing spotlights for that production. And Arthur's my friend and was associate producer and in charge of makeup effects on Found. And when we originally cast the part of Steve with another actor, that actor's family threatened to throw him out of the house. They had some issues with the movie. And so we lost that original actor, and we were in a bind for like a week where we were going to have to push the shoot, and we did end up having to push the shoot considerably. But Arthur really helped to spot Ethan and encourage him to try out, and we saw maybe four or five other guys in a pinch. And Ethan we liked the most, and he really worked out. So it was the movie god shining down, really, that we got Ethan.
Mm-hmm. Were there any scenes that he had a hard time doing because of the gore factor or any of the disturbing parts? Did he have a hard time with any of it?
I don't think Ethan had trouble with the gore. The blood was a little uncomfortable because it was cold outside, and he was practically naked whenever we covered him in blood. But he did have trouble with the racism. He did not like the racist rant that Steve goes into later in the movie. None of us like that. In fact, whenever that's at like a festival or a screening, we all kind of leave the room during that part because we're all a little uncomfortable by it.
Was the blood something that you bought, or did you make your own blood?
You know, on all of our older productions, Arthur would make his own brew, and then when they got to Found, he said, you know, there's really this awesome blood, I think it's called a bucket of blood or a bottle of blood or something like that, and it washes out of stuff. So he just started using that, and he believed in it, and it looked great. So we're actually using a brand name blood.
Okay. Were there effects that you did in post-production, or was everything real-time used in, within the film?
Everything's real-time, shot on set.
Wow.
We're not big fans
now,
of digital effects.
Yeah, me neither.
Now,
how did you get this on, you know, together on such a low budget?
Well, I guess
I don't know if you want to talk about your budget at all.
No, I don't mind talking about it. Some people don't believe me. But I saved up $8,000 to make the movie, and that went to, we bought a Canon 7D to shoot it on. That was about $2,200 at the time. And we spent maybe $300 or $400 on halogen lights. And we got a $300 recorder, a Zoom H4N. I already had a Sennheiser shotgun microphone and a boomstick. And we had to spend maybe $2,000 on makeup supplies for the effects. And then we also catered. So no one paid to work on the movie, but everyone is going to participate in profit as soon as that comes around. And I think it'll be coming around sometime pretty soon. But I don't necessarily recommend trying to make a movie with absolutely no money or as little money as we had. But sometimes you don't have a choice. I think if it's your very first time out and you have no reputation, and I really had no reputation because whatever movies I've done, I hadn't pushed them, and I hadn't done anything with them. So I think you just have to do what you have to do to get it made. And fortunately, we were able to, with a great story by Todd Rigney, get actors mm-hmm. who believed in the material, and the crew was mostly really good friends of ours, and everybody showed up and did their job and was very passionate about it, and it was definitely a labor of love. That's how you do it with not very much money at all. But as soon as you mm-hmm. can pay people, then your budget's going to go up quite a bit, because if you pay anyone, you really need to pay everyone.
Yeah.
And yeah. hopefully we'll be doing that on our next one.
Now, how did you find locations? Was that difficult to get locations secured?
I hate location scouting. It's my least favorite part of the whole process. I just hate it because, especially when you don't have a budget, you can't really offer people anything. You're basically pleading with people, please, can I come in your house for a long time and make a terrible mess mm-hmm. and inconvenience you? And really, we can tell you when we think we're going to be done, but we really have no idea of when we're actually going to be done. And you should never have any misconceptions that you are going to make their life hell. Whoever these people are with their location, it's an inconvenience. It really is. So hopefully next time we can give people money to make them feel better about letting us have their locations. But I guess found we lucked out because the interior house set was all producer Leah Taylor, DP and producer Leah Taylor's family's house, and they were on vacation. So that worked out pretty well. And other than that, the boys' bedrooms were makeup effects guy Arthur Culliver's bedroom, was Steve's bedroom, and Kirk Chastain, who helped on makeup effects and sound, that was Marty's bedroom. So some of the crew sacrificed their rooms for the most of the summer to have those two rooms dressed and ready to go. And then as far as exterior locations, there are some interesting ones in the movie. And that was really just us taking advantage of what we knew we had here in Bloomington, Indiana, like the haunted train sequence in the movie where Marty and David. Yeah, it's really cool. It's a haunted train museum south of Bloomington in Smithville. And the guy is a Vietnam vet who runs that, and he just opens it up every October for tourists. So I think it costs a few bucks. You can walk through this series of maybe four or five train cars that he's getting dressed up in all the spooky shit. And he was cool. We just asked him, and he was like, yeah, sure. That's the cool thing about Indiana is that people don't make movies here, and movies still have this mystification around them. So when you're like a student or a young person and you approach them and say you're making a movie, most people are interested in that. They want to be a part of that because they think it's cool. So we were able to take advantage of that.
Now, I had a friend who saw the movie, and he thought it was very disturbing. And he says, oh, I don't know if you should watch this. Have you had that reaction a lot from people or not so much?
Oh, yeah.
They were very disturbed by it.
We get the reaction's been all over the place. It still fascinates me how people respond to the movie, because some will respond like you just mentioned, and they're very disturbed, and it sticks with them. And that's awesome. I hope to make things that stick with people and make them think and kind of creep them out instead of something that's just in and out and they don't think about it ever again. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who are turned off by that, and they don't ultimately like the movie because they feel like it goes too far. But it seems like for every one person who feels that way, sorry, I have a bird that's chirping, so let me deal with it.
I can't hear it.
So all right, come on out. Come on out, sweet pea. And for every one person that thinks the movie goes too far, there's someone that thinks it doesn't go far enough. There are people in the horror community who don't think the movie's a horror film. And they criticize it for having too much, I guess, drama and character.
I think that's why I liked it, because I'm not like a super horror person, but I really liked the film. And kind of contain all the horror moments to the headless scenes, and those were disturbing for me to watch, but not overly disturbing. But what made it so disturbing was that mask. Where did you find that mask?
The headless mask?
Yeah.
It's in the book that the killer wears a skull mask, so we knew we needed one. And then we thought about just buying one because it's kind of generic. And Arthur was like, nah, let's make our own. And so he did. He sculpted it.
Really?
And I think Shane, the actor that plays the Headless Killer, painted it and put some stitching in it. And that's how it came about.
Yeah, it creeps me out just looking at it.
Cool. Well, that was the goal, so yay.
Yeah. Were you going for shock value at all when you were originally doing this, or was it kind of an after effect, that the fact that people were shocked by it?
I mean, I can't say that we were not going for shock effects, because when you're doing the things that we do in Headless, it's shocking. It's simply shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff at the end of the movie is too. But the way we approached it was that we wanted to try and earn those moments. That's why there's a lot of build-up to both of them. I think Headless is 40 minutes into the movie, and the end is another 40 minutes after that. And a lot of character development has to happen. And Headless is also a substitute for all the gore you don't see in real life. So all the worst violence of the movie is relegated to this exploitation horror film that you can then remember when you're at the end of the movie and you don't actually see the violence occurring. You know how that film influenced Steve, the older brother, and you can use your imagination in regards to what he might be doing. So in some ways, I think the way we approached it was pretty responsible. But yes, it does suck, and I think that's part of horror. You do want to push the envelope a little bit. But instead of some other horror films where they pull out the stops and try to shock you right off the bat, it feels cheap when you do it that way. So we really wanted to try and marry those shocking moments into a narrative, into character, and earn them.
Shane, who played Headless, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I hoped that that's how people would take it, and some do and some don't, but you can't make everybody happy.
When I was asking you earlier about Ethan, I meant Shane for the Headless scenes, as far as, did he have a hard time with doing, the gore scenes in Headless?
He didn't seem to on the day. I think since then he may have backtracked a little bit after his mom saw it. But no, he's really fierce, actually. He eats fire. He does, sideshow stuff at horror conventions sometimes. And I think he eats light bulbs and swallows fire and stuff. So we knew we could push him around a bit, but he volunteered to do most of the stuff that the Headless Killer does. I think he hurt his back a little bit at one point in the movie, but we just worked with him at that point. I think he's lifting Angela Denton off the ground after he's killed her in Headless, but his back hurt, so she had to, push up on her feet to, kind of make herself weightless a little bit while he slung her over her shoulder. So, they pulled together and made it work.
Yeah. There's a lot of topics that this covers that seem very timely, like the bullying issue, for example, and then the family dysfunction. Was that something that you kind of wanted to delve into as a director? And being a sociology major, this must be, right up your alley.
Yeah, I love that stuff because I went through it, and Todd, the author, went through it, and so many people go through it. It's not even uncommon. And so it spoke to me very personally. And when I read Found, the fact that bullying and so many other issues were in it is why I wanted to make it so badly. So I can't say that I manufactured it out of my own desires. It was just there ready-made, because Todd wrote it already. And I think if people relate with it, hopefully it's because we really meant it and it came from a genuine place, at least from Todd and me.
Now, how did you meet up with Todd? Were you guys friends, or how did you collaborate on this?
I work at a self-publishing company, and Todd self-published the book. And I'm in the marketing department, so I always need cover art to represent our products and services. And a lot of what people self-publish is inspirational or feel-good or self-help or poetry or cookbooks, things like that. There aren't very many horror novels, so when a black cover with a skull and a bowling ball bag pops up, it really stands out. And I'm so grateful that he had that cover and that it did stand out when I'm looking at all these books, because it made me want to read the back of it. And then it made me want to look inside the book and read the first page, and the first line was, my brother keeps a human head in his closet. And
mm-hmm.
I knew right away I wanted that to be the first line of the movie, too. And
yeah.
So I was like, I need to find out who this Todd guy is. And I had no idea. You never know what someone's going to be like. And I have this immediate knee-jerk reaction that people are always going to be assholes. So I was afraid he would be. And thank God he wasn't. I got on the internet and looked him up, and at first I found this other Todd Rigney who was, like, in public bathrooms looking up women's skirts somehow. I don't remember.
Wow.
And I thought maybe he would be that pervert. And he wasn't, thank goodness. And since then, we've both, I've learned that his family, like parts of his family, saw those headlines at the same time, and they were like, oh, no, our Todd is a pervert. But he isn't.
Hilarious.
Totally different Todd Rigney. And he's a very unassuming little guy, man. You would never think that he would write something like Found, as horrible as it gets in that narrative. And
mm-hmm.
he knew I had no money. He knew that I couldn't offer him anything up front. And I think he said someone in Finland or Sweden or someone else had already approached him about making it into a movie. But they mm-hmm. didn't, I guess, make a deal fast enough, so I was able to swing in and steal it away, and I'm so glad. And he was supportive about the script. He helped write the script. He approved everything. He had final say. He had final approval of the script, and he was very supportive about any changes that we wanted to make, and we really tried to keep them to cosmetic changes, just stuff to make the movie more visually interesting
mm-hmm.
and not to affect the characters in any way.
Yeah.
So he was a great guy. He was our biggest cheerleader all through production.
The film had such a great quality, the visual quality of it. It almost had a retro feel to it to me. Was that something you intended, or was it just me?
We like retro. We are definitely fans of retro.
I felt like I was watching like an early Spielberg movie that kind of... quality. I was watching the beginning of Super 8 or something, just something about it, and I can't put my finger on it, but there was a quality to it that I thought, this is just from the quality I wanted to watch it. Was that something that you guys did with the camera, or how did that come across? Any idea?
Well, I'm glad it came across, and I don't think I thought about it a whole lot. I thought about it in very specific ways at very specific moments in the movie, like the dinner scene at the beginning is a direct homage to Jaws. It was trying to be anyway.
Oh, great.
Where in
okay.
Jaws, you know, Brody is at the table, and his son starts imitating him, and the
mm-hmm.
wife is in the doorway watching them. That was kind
yeah.
of why Marty and his mom make faces at each other at the table. And
mm-hmm.
and then in the field later in the movie when the brothers hug, that was an homage to the end of The Color Purple when Celia and her sister
uh-huh.
are hugging each other in the sun. So
wow,
there were direct
that,
things
yeah.
like that. But I didn't think about it all the time, but the fact is that I really don't like the way movies are made today.
Yeah.
I could still enjoy individual movies, but the stylistic trends are to speed up the tempo, speed up the pace, don't even have a first act anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The editing is just rapacious. The shots are not
mm-hmm.
very thoughtfully composed anymore. Instead, directors just tend to have like this multiple camera angle coverage of not very well thought out shots, and then the editor just kind of mixes it all up in the end. And the result is a movie that's kind of ugly. It's like an impression
mm-hmm.
of the blur of the movie. And I really like the old-school invisible-style approach that I think Spielberg still abides by, where you do set up a shot. You compose it well. You have the composition of the shot mean something. You let it stand still for, you know, 5 seconds at least. And you let characters move around in it. And it's subconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still trying to cling to the movies that I grew up with and even movies made before I was born. Because I don't like the Michael Bay style or
right.
God knows other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get dizzy just watching some of those movies.
Well, it's incomprehensible.
And you can't keep track
like
of what's going on.
Yeah, and I want to get wrapped up in moments, you know? I don't want the movie to go by so quickly that I can't latch on to anything. either emotionally or viscerally. I remember even watching Star Trek Into Darkness, and I liked that movie overall. But every now and then, there would be a shot, and I would be like, oh, that's a pretty shot. That means something to me. But before I could really comprehend it, it was gone. So even that movie was edited too quickly.
Yeah.
So I think subconsciously, yeah, I'm really trying to crusade and bring back some of those qualities. At least I hope.
I think that's why it was so effective. Yeah. And you won several awards, too. Tell us about that.
Started off at Elvira's Horror Hunt, and I remember when we were making the movie, we wanted to show it at Horror Hound because there are a lot of horror conventions in our area in the Midwest, and that's where a lot of the indie filmmakers in our area premiere their movies. So we were like, yay, when it's done, we'll show it at the Horror Hound. And then we found out they weren't taking submissions because instead they were going to have Elvira's Horror Hunt. And in order to show your movie at the convention that fall, it would have to make it through, you know, the judging and everything, and Elvira would have to pick it. And I was like, well, we don't have a shot now. We're going to find somewhere else to premiere the movie. But we did end up submitting to that festival, and we made it through one round, and we were notified, and we made it through another round, and we were notified, and we were ecstatic. And then we won.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. You can't ask for better launching that. You just can't. And and it kept going. So We're lucky. We made a good movie that we wanted to make, and there are a lot of people out there who like it, and we're so grateful. And every award that we get or any good reviews is just icing on the cake.
How long did it take you to make?
I would encourage other filmmakers not to forget the rest of the world, because I think it's easy to only think of America. And we have found that audiences in Europe and Australia have really responded to the movie, maybe even more favorably than the American audience overall, especially in Europe and overseas. They have more patience over there. So if you have a slow burn type of movie, that's nothing to them. They love that stuff. Whereas over here, I think young horror-loving fans are kind of conditioned more by the Saw movies and stuff, and things have to be like bam, bam, bam in your face to keep their attention. So don't forget the rest of the world, because there are horror fans in every country.
Yeah, that's important. What else? What other advice would you have for someone that's new to making a horror film, how they would make an effective horror film? What would be your advice?
Well, I don't know about effective first. but anyone can do it. That's the really good news.
Good film.
And, yeah, it's so cheap. Cameras are really affordable. If you want to do it badly enough, you'll save your money and you'll get a camera. You don't even have to get a camera the camera we got. You could get a Canon Rebel, which is like $800. I mean, you're probably going to have to spend at least $500 or $800 to get a decent camera that's going to have good resolution on a normal-sized movie screen or a Blu-ray. But you don't have to get a Red. You can when you can afford to. But the fact of the matter is that our movie has played at festivals with multi-million dollar budgets. And our movie is $8,000. And our resolution is barely 2K. There was one screen, only one screen at Toronto After Dark, where the what was our resolution, 1980? Or 1920, it's not quite 2K, and only on that one screen could you maybe start to see it de-res a little bit. So don't go crazy. Don't think that on your first movie you have to use the Red, you have to have 4K, you have to have $1 million, because you know what, your first movie is going to be shit anyway, unless you're some genius Orson Welles person. Your first, second, third movies probably aren't going to be that great. So just use what you can get. Don't worry about being, you know, a total professional, quote-unquote, your first time out. Cut your teeth on stuff. Make mistakes. Let yourself be able to make mistakes. And if you really want to stand out, make sure you pay attention to lighting and sound, because the most amateur productions that I ever see, they don't have good lighting. They have flat lighting. Don't put your lights behind the camera. Don't put them in front of the actors. Do something creative that's going to help them pop off the background. Put some thought into the lighting, because the audience will subconsciously know they're looking at an inferior production value, even if they can't put their finger on it. and sound quality is the other thing. We did the best we could. It's amazing we did as well as we did with what we had, but we're going to even improve our standards in that area on the next movie. Pay attention to those things. And I guess I should also say acting. Don't test your friends. Your friends probably aren't good actors. So try to go to a university. Go to local theater companies. Find out who the actors are and use them. And don't be afraid to work with older actors. I know that when you're in college and you make student films, you end up seeing a lot of student films where the parents are the same age as the kids. The filmmakers are too afraid to approach older actors. And what we have found is that older actors in small communities like ours, they don't have a lot to do, but they still love acting. So if you give them an opportunity, they're really going to relish it. So don't be afraid of them. Just because they might have a few lines in their face doesn't mean they're scary.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to shoot the film?
Too damned long. And that's because of the casting issue I mentioned earlier. It pushed our schedule away from summer when we knew we had the kids available.
Uh-huh.
And we ended up having to shoot into the school year as a result. And that means we couldn't shoot on the weekdays. So we shot Headless and Deep Dwellers during the summer and got them finished. And then we started shooting Found right before school started. And we kept shooting into the beginning of December since we could only film on weekends. So it was an endurance test, and that was the single hardest part of making the whole movie, was just being in it for so long and not being able to see the forest for the trees. We are very committed to making sure that does not happen again. But if you don't work with kids, I think it's a lot easier.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I want to make sure you give out your website so that people can find out more about the movie and, you know, more about it and where it's going to show next. I know it's showing at the Florida SuperCon, Super Geek Film Festival on July 6th. I know that. But give us your website.
You can go to foundmovie.net, and that is where we are always putting the latest information. Our festival run was primarily last year, but we do still have a few more things coming up. At the very end of May, we have a showing in Madrid at the Nocturna Film Festival, and then we have an online screening Sunday, I think it's June 1st, at the virtual film festival called Sadistic Master Film Festival. That's out of France.
Okay.
You can watch the film anywhere.
Oh, okay. Great.
And then
all right.
I wish we could say more about our big wide home video release, but we have to let the distributors make those announcements. But I can tell you it's coming this fall in all English-speaking countries. And then it will probably start coming around to non-English-speaking countries as well shortly thereafter.
Great. Okay. All right. Well, we're running out of time, but I really thank you for coming on the show today, and I'm sure I will talk to you later. But thank you very much, and in your next movie, we'll bring you back.
Awesome. I appreciate it, Rachel. Thanks for having me on. Any chance I get to talk about it is a gift.
All right. Thanks, Scott. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, great conversation with Scott Shermer, and he mentioned some of the festivals that the film is going to be showing on, but definitely if you are in the Miami area, you want to come to the FSC Super Geek Film Festival, which I'm also a part of. I'm kind of the talent coordinator, coordinating a lot of things and doing Q&As and panels and helping to coordinate a lot of different things. So come to the festival, which is at the Miami Convention Center, July 3rd through 6th, and his film is going to be shown July 6th, so you can see the film yourself. But, you know, yes, this is a horror film, but like he said, the horror is very contained. The real gory part is contained, and the rest is more of a drama, and it's very well done, I thought, because I'm not a horror person. I don't watch horror films really at all. And I just had to watch this movie because I heard so much about it from my friends, and I'm glad I did. So it was great that he was able to come on today. Okay, guys, what else do I have to tell you? Coming up on May 29th in Boca Raton, right here where I live in Florida, there's the Doc Miami Film Fest is having a special screening at the Willow Theater in Boca Raton of a movie called In the Footsteps of Willie Sutton. So if you hear this radio show before then, you can go check it out. May 29th at 7 p.m. right here in Boca Raton. And you can find out more about that at docmiami.org. Okay? Also, for the Super Geek Film Festival, just Google it. You can find out all about some of the films that we have coming up. We do have some of our film schedule up on the website now, so you can see some of the other great films that we will be at the film festival. The deadline has passed for film submission for that. But also, guys, I mentioned last time that I have a magazine called Independent Streak Magazine. I'm working on my June issue right now. The May issue is already out. If you go to independentstreakmagazine.com, you can see the magazine. Let me know if you have any issues with seeing it. I would like that feedback. You can always email me at ravenprods@yahoo.com. That's ravenprods at yahoo.com. I'm still tweaking a lot of things. The website itself is still under construction in a lot of ways. But if you go on there, you can see there's a big picture of the magazine cover, which has Jason Priestley on it. And it has a link below the picture, and if you click on the link, you should be able to go to the magazine, which is a flip book. It's online, and you can flip through the pages and see the double-page spread of the magazine, and then double-click on the pages, and it zooms in so you can read the content. And it's 16 pages long, 17 including the cover. And I'm working on the June issue right now, which will have Joan Collins on the cover. It's a little bit different. being that she's not an independent filmmaker, but I did get a chance to see her show, which was shown here, and take pictures of her. I was one of four photographers that got a chance to take pictures, and so I'm putting a whole story about her in the magazine as sort of a feature story. But I will have interviews with directors from around the world, other information about films that are coming up on VOD, events, etc. So you want to check out the magazine that will be coming out June 1st, if not sooner. If you are an advertiser or you have a product or service that you want to advertise, please let me know because I am looking for ads for the June issue. I have quite a few already, but I can always use some more. And you can email me again at ravenprods@yahoo.com and let me know what you have, and I can give you information. Ads start as low as $25. And would be happy to give you all the details about that. Also, if you're a filmmaker and you'd like to come on this program, please email me about that. I'm always looking for events and stories. And if you have something that you want to submit to be put in the magazine, let me know. I just had somebody contact me from France who's at the Cannes Film Festival and would like to submit pictures for the magazine. I said, great. So I'm open. You know, just let me know. Okay, I'm going to be putting people from the Super Geek Film Festival on the show for the next few weeks leading up to the actual film festival itself. And, you know, just keep looking out. Every week I'm going to have somebody different. So stay tuned because I will have all kinds of fun stuff coming up in the next few weeks. So I will be back next Sunday as usual at 1 o'clock, so please tune in then. And listen to someone brand new. And please tell your friends about the show and put it out there for me. That would be great. And let them know there's over 100 interviews through the last 2 years or so that they can go back and listen to. People, not only filmmakers, but producers, screenwriters, special effects artists, etc. So there's something for everybody. And also tell them to check out my magazine. Again, independentstreakmagazine.com. Thank you, guys. All right. Bye-bye.